Welcome to another episode of Ordinary Old Catholic Me. Okay, here it is. I'm just not in a good mood these days. I'm guessing I'm not alone in that. All week long, I've been thinking of the translations of Genesis 6, beginning at about paragraph 12. One phrase that just kept appearing unbidden is, quote, "the earth is filled with violence." Here's a version from the USCCB version of the Bible, and I forget which translation. But the earth was corrupt in the view of God and full of lawlessness. When God saw how corrupt the earth had become, since all mortals had corrupted their ways on earth, God said to Noah, "I see that the end of all mortals has come, for the earth is full of lawlessness because of them. So I am going to destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood, equip the ark with various compartments, and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall build it. The length of the ark will be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Make an opening for daylight and finish the ark a cubit above it. Put the ark's entrance on its side. You will make it with bottom, second, and third decks. On my part, I am about to bring the floodwaters on the earth to destroy all creatures under the sky in which there is the breath of life. Everything on the earth shall perish. I will establish my covenant with you. You shall go into the ark, you and your sons, your wife and your sons' wives with you. Of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal, and of every kind of thing that crawls on the ground, two of each will come to you, that you may keep them alive. Moreover, you are to provide yourself with all the food that is to be eaten and store it away, that it may serve as provisions for you and for them." Noah complied. He did just as God had commanded him. In any translation, we know what God did, as we see, as we are told. And he told Noah to build an ark, and he destroyed the world, our Lord did, except for the righteous. The ever so few righteous, those who had listened to him, and it was they who repopulated the earth. This time, our time, I think it's going to be even uglier, and boy, are we begging him to go for it. There is ugliness near and far, with people celebrating the ugliness and forcing it on the good or those attempting to be good. I'm a facilitator of a class required of paid employees and volunteers at parishes regarding the protection of children from sexual abuse. Of course, a lot of it was occasioned by the horrible revelations that occurred beginning in the early 2000s. What kind of world is it, has it been, that we have to explain to people that harming children by sexual abuse is not only wrong, but anathema? Yeah, it existed long ago, and in some cultures in the past, and was it the Greeks, it was even acceptable to them. But now it has become, no doubt in large part because of the internet, a scourge with pornography of every stripe at one's fingertips. The society deems it a good thing to introduce sexuality to five-year-olds who should only be dreaming of Santa Claus and unicorns. Ordinary things, aside from the big ones in the international world that are slowly pressing like hot lava upon us, are impinging on every moment. We have a government we can't believe saying things that are purely unbelievable. We have prices running rampant for essentials, not for luxuries, your bread, your milk, your eggs. Now, I saw that gas, at least in Los Angeles, slightly came down this week to like the mid-$5 a gallon. We are supposedly chastising Iran and Russia while still buying oil from them and sending at least to Iran, we're still sending money or allowing money to be loosed to them. Even with your own service providers, you're lucky that time spent on the phone tree isn't an hour or more only to be told to go somewhere else, or they hang up on you. And then they have the nerve nerve to ask you to fill out a survey about their exceptional customer service. My medical group has for years been asking its patients for a $500 administrative fee to do things extra that really aren't extra because their costs are too high and they just don't get enough payment from insurance for all the tests they do. Which brings up another tale for me is how often they want to do tests, whether they need to be done or not. But if you don't do them, like you don't get, say, a flu shot or a COVID shot, you are yourself anathema, or certainly right wing. The last letter I got was, to me, a soft extortion for that $500. And this time I paid it with a letter that basically expressed my dissatisfaction. They cashed the check. I haven't heard back from the medical group with regard to my distress or my disappointment or my critique. Do you know that yesterday I got another email now with a reminder of the seriousness of their request, but please ignore it if you've paid. I'll be curious to see what that $500 buys me. I have to make my appointments now, months or a year in advance, to see my primary care physician. But luckily, I do have the ability to go without getting his permission to other doctors as I need them. We are being moved into and around a maze. And then there is this great question mark about why people are upset or thoughtless or violent. And when evil is called good and good is called evil, does your head not feel as if it's about to explode? And if you have this sense of the insanity, can you imagine what God the Creator is doing while watching and what he's comprehending about his creatures? I made a promise, a sort of an effort at small mortification. I don't seem to be able to do the big ones, to attempt when it begins to feel out of control in the small and the big world around us, to pray and to maintain my civility, at least that. I managed a couple of times this past week when, after some ordinary insanity, and I ended up reaching some poor representative who himself or herself hasn't got a bit of control over the shenanigans of every company and leader, I really made the effort not to express the anger I was feeling. I told them whatever dissatisfaction I had, or I made a critique quietly and asked them to pass it on, not expecting that they will, and recognizing, therefore, that my contact isn't going to have any impact. The people on the other end were grateful that I wasn't screaming at them. One said, related to a particular problem that I was calling about that affects a whole lot of people, that she had been cursed out a great deal that week. She thanked me profusely. But then the large things of the world looming just outside our respective doors and the small things, they multiplied. And yesterday, once again, I was despairing of any ability to, as Bruno Lanteri said, begin again. He promises that the Lord wants us to begin, even if we fall 1,000 times. But I was despairing of any ability to do this. I try to do my daily meditations. I kind of half-heartedly did them. I listened to the soothing voice of one priest reminding me that God looks at me and you with profound love. And I just wasn't able to pull out of the sense of desolation. The thing I'm grappling with, and I do you maybe, I wonder, is the chasm between, for me, all the prayers and the meditations and the treatises, the theology and what's in front of us every moment, is such a profound disturbance in the earth, a violence, a corruption, that I can't avoid being touched by it and wanting to give up. And those things that are tools, somehow I seem unable to reach for them. Everything reminds me of the violence and the corruption, even the smallest thing. I'm sure I mentioned this a while ago, that one time when I was in a garage having parked at a nursing facility to visit a friend, I noticed this little mouse trying to take a sip of water from a small puddle on the floor. The janitors that were around there noticed him too. Now, clearly the creature didn't run and so couldn't have been well. And I knew that once I passed these men, they would scoop it up and they would kill it. It's just a mouse. It's just a mouse, right? But every time I go there now, particularly after a day in which everything else feels dark, I think of that mouse, and to me, it's a symbol of the sin that ravages us, that pervades our lives and wherever we go. I was in that garage yesterday on the way to visiting my friend, as I do, and I found myself starting to cry, thinking of that day that I saw the mouse just trying to survive and doomed. So, with the presses of our society and this time of history and personal tasks and obligations that seemed challenging from their start, and because that is my apparent physical and psychological makeup, I was just about as down as I could be yesterday. And then last night, knowing that I had to be awake and energetic to facilitate a course on protecting children, which itself feels an enormous cosmic task, I couldn't sleep. I was both raging at God that these moods that keep overtaking me would stop. Please let them stop, and please let them stop, and apologetic for the fact that I have them. I said an act of contrition, but I have a feeling it didn't rise to one of perfect contrition. At a class at our parish last week on the art of dying, when purgatory came up, someone said that she just didn't understand how God could, knowing and seeing how much we go through all our lives, say to people who were trying and who clearly really are destined for heaven because they do try to live holy lives, that they still have to go to purgatory. Theologically, purgatory is considered a good thing, as I said. It means that you're going to heaven, but that certain venial attachments to sin. Now, remember, if you die with a mortal sin on your soul, well, that's a damning thing and means hell and not purgatory. But if you have stayed in grace, committing no mortal sins, still you have not rid yourself, even with the grace or the help of our Lord, the help of prayer, you have not completely rid yourself of the totality of your disordered attachments. And so there's this stay in purgatory. And at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, section 1472, there is this. To understand this doctrine and practice of the Church, it's necessary to understand that sin has a double consequence. Grave sin deprives us of the communion with God and therefore makes us incapable of eternal life, the privation of which is called the eternal punishment of sin. On the other hand, every sin, even venial, entails an unhealthy attachment to creatures, which must be purified either here on earth or after death in the state called purgatory. This purification frees one from what is called, quote, temporal punishment of sin. These two punishments must not be conceived of as a kind of vengeance inflicted by God from without, as obviously my friend was suggesting, but as following from the very nature of sin. A conversion which proceeds from a fervent charity can attain the complete purification of the sinner in such a way that no punishment would remain. I guess one might call purgatory kind of the third base of eternity. And once there's a base hit, you get to go home. But I found myself still sympathizing with my friend and my theory based on reading the catechism and hearing how my pastor seemed to respond to my thought was that it's a possibility that if we're working with grace here, using the sacraments, mortifying ourselves, meditating, praying, doing good works, not as a bribe to God, as I know our Protestant brothers seem to think that it's all about if we just keep working, we'll make it. That's not it. The response of works, the love of works in response to the love of God, is merely a cooperation with him. And therefore, the time in purgatory, and I use the word time in quotes, won't be very long. And again, the reminder that purgatory isn't punishment, but a recognition that as creatures who have been surrounded in and immersed in sin, it's unlikely that most of us will be pure enough upon death to enter God's purest presence without a complete cleanup. But I have to be honest, yesterday and last night, you could have quoted 1,000 words from the Catechism, and I still would have felt bereft. I knew that I was being prodded by a less than sterling character who has many names, the devil. He knows well my melancholy and my anxiety, and he counts on them, and he counts on yours. And oh, he counts on my anger when I fail. I imagine sometimes that Judas was angry at Jesus for not bringing the messianic age in the way Judas thought it should be brought, the way he was taught it would be done, by the earthly conquering of nations which had enslaved the Jewish people. In anger, he betrayed. In anger, he threw away the 30 pieces of silver. In anger and despair and presumption, he hung himself. I know I have to beware of those kinds of moments, not in that kind of betrayal, but the betrayal of not going back to him when I feel the lowest and I become overwhelmed with the violence in all of its species of the earth and can't see the gifts of grace still being offered to me. I like to tell myself that the prayers of others, I need to tell myself that the prayers of others who have told me that they pray for me help hold me in place and helped last night at other times in the past hold me in place close to despair, ever too close, but still not quite conceding to it, scary though the thought of this happening again, as it does, is. But it all allowed me to get to today, when yesterday's deep dive into, let's call it, the abyss, and I know that others have it worse, I know, but when you're alone, your abyss is deep enough. Somehow it receded, or no, I was able to float back, or I don't know, come back to the surface. They always say, and in terms of prayer, and my spiritual director says it to me, turn it over to God. I guess I sort of did, though it was more like I was throwing it at him angrily. And as I am back to meditation and prayer today, I guess he heard me, though I'm ashamed to admit of the depth of the internal threat not to persevere and to throw my faith away. I tell you, it's no easier for the religious than for the non-religious. I think it's harder in many ways because you have this belief, this faith that these other things, these graces, this eternity, this wonderful beatific vision is out there. But all you can see is the face of the overt wickedness and cruelty of the world and just the insanity of everyday life. But you have to, I have to, like, hold on, because there is always a source, a plank, the source, God himself. At those critical moments, he is indeed the only place to go, the salvation of our very souls. And my job, your job, is to be like Noah or Job or any of the saints, because now, right now, in this time, each individual decides on the yes or no to God. I know that over the last 3 years, I've probably done a surfeit of variations of this theme, but I also know that what angst I feel, I'm not unique in it, that if I'm feeling this, that there are many others that are feeling it, and they need the same support to keep persevering. And as I said last week, I think, to keep praying for the grace of final perseverance, because It's really quite equivocal from moment to moment. Well, so ends another episode of Ordinary Old Catholic Me, which I hope you found useful. I don't know if the word enjoyed would quite go, but I would ask you to pray for me, and hopefully I will remember to pray for you. I find lately that when it comes to praying and I start to say various names, I realize that really there is no one out there who doesn't need prayers. And so I sometimes end by saying, everyone, everyone, Lord, I pray for everyone who is struggling to know you. Have a good week.